Now, I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. And I see a number of you have put in some messages into the Q&A about how excited you are for our topic. So what I'd like to do now is pose a question to each of you so we can learn a little bit about your background and familiarity with our topic today. So I'm going to launch a poll. A new window should have popped up on the screen for everyone asking if you have experience with groundwater fate in transport modeling. You'll see three choices below the question: yes, a lot, yes, some, or no, none at all. Simply click the circle to the left of the answer that best characterizes your experience and then hit the submit button in the lower right. Now, it looks like about three quarters of you have shared your responses, and I'm seeing a very clear trend emerge in the data as we're collecting it. So I'll give you just a few more seconds here to consider your answer and submit it in. If you're having any issues with that poll, don't worry. You can send me a message into the Q&A and just let me know what your experience level is. And I'll go ahead and close the poll here in 3, 2, 1. All right, let's look at those results. So, overwhelmingly, about two-thirds of you have some experience with groundwater fate in transport. But we do have a bit of a split. Some of you seem to have a lot, but there's a large portion. Almost a quarter of you have no experience with modeling at all. So, we'll try to be mindful of that when we talk about terms and modeling names and other simulation concepts. So, I want to thank you for sharing your background on that. Let me close the poll out and bring our speaker up to the stage. So I'm going to bring his video up on the screen. And Noman, I'll ask you to go ahead and start to share your screen as I introduce the audience to you. And I'll confirm once we have your slides up on the screen. So Dr. Ahsan Usman is joining us from EPA Region 4, where he provides scientific support to Superfund and RCRA sites in that region. He's a civil and environmental engineer with over 25 years of experience in subsurface flow and solute transport modeling, site characterization, groundwater remediation, and modeling software development. He has developed and co-authored, as well as reviewed, multiple modeling software packages like Footprint, REMCLOR, REMFUEL for EPA Center for Subsurface Modeling Support in Ada, Oklahoma. He's also perform technical review of groundwater modeling software packages and site-specific applications of these models in over 100 Superfund and RCRA sites. I can't think of a better speaker to talk about groundwater modeling and the complexity in PFAS modeling. So with that, I can confirm we've got your slides up. I'll turn the floor over to you for today's presentation.
Thank you, Jean, and thank you, the audience. I see 320 people and about 600 people signed up, and I didn't expect to be talking to such a big audience. This talk was given last year to our groundwater forum. We have a groundwater forum which involves hydrogeologists from all the regional offices and headquarters of EPA, and we have some state representative also. So this was the talk I gave in our annual meeting last year, and from there on, you know, this is the second time I'm going to present this to you all. So good afternoon again, everyone, and everybody around the world listening to this talk, and thank you for your time. Okay, so this is the... All right, so I'll start with a little background on groundwater modeling. I saw about a quarter of the people didn't have any background on modeling, but there are quite a few who has done some modeling and some are experts listening to this talk. So my objective here is to give a brief demonstration of how groundwater modeling is done, and some discussion on analytical models that we have developed in Ada, Oklahoma, in our ORD facilities, talking about numerical models, how to do modeling for saturated zone. And finally, I'll bring a demonstration from a journal article where PFAS fate and transport modeling was done in an unsaturated zone soil. Right. Well, to begin with, the first thing you have to do is set up your groundwater flow modeling. So flow is... everything starts from the flow modeling. So typically what we do in a saturated zone modeling, we do, we solve Dirk's equation, and we have lots of data for groundwater elevation, hydraulic conductivity values, your your aqua test, stock test, pump test data, all those information. You know the boundary conditions well, so you can actually decide whether you want to go with an analytical model or a numerical model. And I'm going to explain what are those in a little bit. So you start with the flow model, and then you from there you go on to the fate and transport of the chemical of concern that you have. So you come up in a situation most commonly where you model for saturated zone, like the groundwater moving in an aquifer, where soil is saturated, so you don't have to, your moisture content is saturated, so your porosity moisture content kind of match up each other. Your hydraulic conductivity, whether it's a homogeneous means hydraulic conductivity doesn't change with space. And anisotropy means your all the direction like X, Y, and Z direction, you have the hydraulic conductivity or any other parameters that isotropic means are equal. So analytical models in saturated zone usually assumes that that everything is homogeneous and isotropic. And if not, then you think about whether we should go for a numerical model, which requires you to do a lot more, give a lot more effort, time, cost, and everything involving calibrating a numerical model and doing it in a full scale. So for a numerical model, you can deal with a lot of heterogeneous conditions for hydraulic conductivity or any other modeling parameters mostly that you can think of. What does heterogeneous means? Your hydraulic conductivity is not same in the entire space that you're trying to model. Okay, it can vary from space to space. It can vary horizontally. It can vary vertically. So you need to deal with all those variations in a modeling setup, and you can only do that in a numerical model, not in an analytical model. Then it comes to the Vero zone, which is the unsaturated zone. This is the a zone above the water table where you have more complexity. You have unsaturated soil, which means you have the water phase, you have the solid phase, and you have the air pockets in there, which means your moisture content in your soil is not fully saturated at certain points, which gives the complexity in the model. Your hydraulic conductivity is not going to be constant, it's going to be heterogeneous, it will be a function of the moisture content. Theta here is the moisture content. In my talk, whenever you see the theta term, that'll be the moisture content. So K as a function of the moisture content makes it more complex because you even if it's a homogeneous soil type, your hydraulic conductivity will vary based on the moisture content in the soil, which is going to be the complex part in Vero zone modeling. So what you do, typically you solve the Richter's equation, and I'll show you the equation in a slide. So you solve the Richter's equation for flow, and then you have to think about when you do the fate and transport, you have to think about how the air-water interface actually affect your transport, and it's going to be significant when you're dealing with volatile organic compounds or semi-volatile because those chemicals like chlorinated solvents or BTEX compounds, those are the chemicals who are going to participate, partition between the air space and the water phase and to some and to the solid phase also. So you have multiple phases where these chemicals could be getting affected. And the third type of modeling we see a lot is particle tracking modeling. The most common one is ModPath, which is a package that comes with ModFlow. So what it is actually tells you how the water particle is going to move as calibrate the numerical model. So it only particle tracking is only done for numerical models. So what you do, before you move from groundwater flow model to the fate and transport model, you need to do the particle tracking and see if the particles are moving in the direction of the plume that you know is moving. So it's a very important piece because as you move from flow model where you have a lot of information already available, a lot of data available, you go to the transport model, you don't have as much information. And that brings you with the uncertainty that you have to deal with the fate and transport model, which is going to be a lot more than the flow model. And in that case, before you go to the Fedrin transfer model, we always try to look at how the particle tracking is showing, whether it matches the plume that we already have. So that's an important piece that I always recommend doing before you move to the full scale Fedrin transport model in a numerical modeling setup. All right. So talking about analytical model is very important, very useful. We have done quite a few of those in IPA's ORD office, and those are all freely available. And I'm gonna name a few who doesn't know the name of those models. These are basically assumed as a unidirectional flow. So your groundwater is flowing in one direction. It's not moving in the X, Y, or Z direction. It's only moving in one X direction. And you can have a three-dimensional dispersion. So groundwater moving in one direction, and it can spread in X, Y, and Z direction as it moves through the process of diffusion and dispersion. These are the term dispersion is associated with diffusion. Those who didn't do the modeling in the past, if you understand the diffusion, it's a molecular diffusion is for something that is not moving, kind of, spreading in three dimension, and dispersion is associated with vertical, with the groundwater flow movement and the diffusion term. So those two together becomes the dispersion. So if you look at the equation here, we call it ADE, which is advection dispersion equation, which is derived from a mass balance equation. So this is the term, the concentration as a function of time. R is the retardation factor, and this is the term with advection. So Vx is the velocity of groundwater flow in one direction, like I was saying. It's only one direction for flow. And if you see dispersion, you have the three dimension X, Y, and Z. This little parenthesis is for dispersion. And the remaining part here is for different kind of reaction, like this one is a first order rate constant of a decaying constant. So when you solve it, there are many ways you can solve it. This is the most common model that we use, the Domenico solution. If you look at it, the three-dimension figure in here, this part is associated with advection, and the second and third parentheses are part of the dispersion in the Y and Z direction. So this is most commonly used analytical equation that we have used in many models like BioClore and BioScreen. RAMClore, on the other hand, is also in one-dimensional method, but it uses a different type of solution, which is explained in this paper. But it doesn't go with the same concept of solution like the Domenico solution. So what is the use of analytical models for saturated zone? We commonly use this for a screening level application. Like, for example, you want to get a quick answer to your problem. You want to simplify the assumptions to the point that you can actually get an idea of whether you should be doing kind of screen out a number of situation or number of sites into the most critical ones. You use analytical model, which is quick and easy to set up, easy to run. You can run multiple times in a very short period of time, and you get an answer that is kind of a screening level answer. If you feel like at that point that no, with too much uncertainty involved with our assumptions for analytical model, then you can go to the next step where the numerical modeling is concerned. So when you talk about numerical models, you have to solve the equation numerically. So you bring in variability of hydraulic conductivity. As you can see in this equation, you have Kx, Ky, and Kz. The differential equation becomes more complicated. So the only way to solve it is either through finite difference or finite element method. There are other methods also involved right now. But these are the two most common ones. For groundwater world, finite difference is the most common solution, but there are some good finite element models as well. So in a numerical setup, what you do, you have a you have a uh, you know you just you kind of divide the entire modeling domain into a grid system. It's a three-dimensional grid, and you have a nodes like the joints in here from next to it, one joint to the next, it connected, and then you numerically solve using these techniques to get to the solution. So the most common one that you use is Modflow for saturated zone. For fracture zone, there are other type of models also, but a lot of people use Modflow-based model for fracture zone also. And you know, the latest models in Modflow can do the dual porosity thing, which is the modeling the mobile and immobile phase of the porous media. And a lot of people actually use that technique to compensate for the fracture system that you can model with Modflow. So when it comes to unsaturated zone, you're dealing with the airspace in the middle of the soil particles, right? So for saturated zone, you only have solid and water interface, but when it comes to the unsaturated zone, you bring in the air phase, so which means you have air water interface, you have air solid interfaces also coming into action. But when it gets saturated, then the unsaturated model becomes like, and should be behaving like a saturated zone model, because you at that point you only have the soil water interface. So from there, now we are bringing in the PFAS faded transport, so which is adding more complexity. So far we just talked about the hydraulic properties. Now you bring in the chemical that would be behaving in a different way than any regular chemical like the one we model usually. So when it comes to PFAS, it has a head and a tail. The head is hydrophilic, which means it mixes with water nicely, and the tail, which is the carbon and fluoride bond, which goes like a big chain, which is hydrophobic, right? So which means it doesn't want to mix with water. If you look at this little cartoon here, you can see the hydrophilic part is attached to the water, which is the blue color in here, and the hydrophobic ones are trying to stick in the air as much as it can. But then when it goes down in here, you see it gets stuck to the organic matters that is in the soil particle. And it can partition between the soil and the solid and the water phase through the presence of organic matter, which is what we commonly use in looking at the partitioning. Here we have a partitioning between the air and the water phase as well. So for PFAS, you see, you have a tendency to aggregate in the air-water interface, right? For example, you see these figures kind of showing you the presence of PFAS because of this little green bond for the strong carbon fluoride bond that you have, the long chain and the short chain. So it makes it, the longer the chain, it'll be most likely to partition with the air, while the shorter chain would try to, you know, it can actually overwhelm by the partitioning in the water phase. So that's how it can behave in an unsaturated condition. So as you were saying, that when you have the unsaturated soil, the PFAS is partitioning not only with the solid particle, it also partitioning with the air phase. That means there will be two part of retardation coming into picture, right? One would be retardation from sorption to the solid particle, and also for sorption to the air phase. So we call it retardation factor in modeling. Basically, what it is, it's kind of slowing down the migration of the chemical through the soil media, right? So how does it behave when you talk about retardation factor and biodegradation for plume migration? This is a simple breakthrough curve. If you look at it, there are four lines in here with the retardation factor of 1, 2, 3, and 4. One means there's no retardation. It's like any chemical like chlorine or sodium is gonna completely miscible to water and it will move with the water particle. That would be a retardation factor of one. When it comes down to two or three and four, you're talking about more of the organic component that would get stick to the soil particle. So how does it behave when you look at the breakthrough curve? If you look at it, you see the first solid line is retardation factor of one. So it breaks through it immediately and it goes, the peak goes way higher, right? While at retardation factor of four, you see your peak is much lower than the retardation factor of one. So retardation factor actually reducing the peak concentration. At the same time, it's also delaying the breakthrough. So you're getting delayed because the particles are getting stuck to the solid particle. The chemicals are getting stuck there, and it's kind of slowly getting filtered out in a way, right? So it's the delay in breakthrough. With the delay, with the retardation, you also see another thing is the tail kind of is elevated, which means this is the reason we see the back diffusion. If you know the term, back diffusion is the particle that is stick to the soil matrix, and when the clean water goes away, you know, the contaminated water goes away, the clean water comes in, those matrix can slowly you know, discharge some of the contaminants into the water, and that could be enough for the MCL, the low MCL or low cleanup target you have for many chemicals. And for PFAS, it's going to be extremely low. So when you look at these, so retardation factor, what it does, it delays the breakthrough, it reduces the peak. At the same time, it creates a tail that is going to be a part of the reason for back diffusion for a long, long time. You can see the time kind of goes so long in here, and the tail stays above zero, which means still back diffusion is happening. On the other hand, if you look at biodegradation, if you look at in this here, this is a delayed curve because of absorption. And when you add degradation to it, what it does, it reduces the peak, but it doesn't cause the delay any further than retardation. So when you add a degradation, like a first order, you know, decay or anything in your model, it'll reduce the peak like that. But your breakthrough delay is not going to be there. Your tail is not going to be there as well. This back diffusion part is for higher degree, higher retardation factor. You can see this one, this red dotted line is kind of further delayed over here, and the peak went down below than this one, which means you have a you're going to have some tail of for back diffusion. Now, one thing about PFAS, you have to remember the our cleanup condition criteria is going to be very, very low. Our regulatory number, which is we are still haven't come up with an MCL, but it's going to be very low. So even if it doesn't break through at an earlier time, the what we call the front end of the or the leading front of the plume could be enough to have a have it reach the MCL or the cleanup criteria at a very low concentration over here. All right, so now talking about modeling, how do we model unsaturated zone soil? We have three phases: air phase, water phase, and solid phase, as we have discussed before. This is the Richard equation we are talking about. As we know, the moisture content is going to change with time and space because, you know, as the wetting front is going to move through, your water is going to get saturated, and the moisture content will change. And when moisture content changes, the pressure also going to change because with the presence of air pockets, you'll have a negative pressure on the soil at a given location until it gets saturated. So your pressure is going to be negative, and as the moisture content changes, that pressure suction potential or pressure head will change also. And little alpha in here is actually the angle of vertical axis. It's not a you know, soil metric parameter. So first, you have to look at the hydraulic properties. You know, for saturated zone, we just had one or two parameters: porosity and hydraulic conductivity, right? And it's you know, for confined aquifers, we have the specific storage and a specific yield for unconfined aquifer. But here, When you're talking about Vedder zone, you have so much variability, right? You have a soil, the pressure head, you see the negative pressure in here, it changes with the moisture content. So H versus Terra is a very important. You need to establish this relationship before you can actually apply the model, right? So you have to calibrate for this with the modeling parameters. So there are many models for defining the hydraulic properties for unsaturated soil. My favorite one is VG model, which is Van Gennepen model, which is given over here. If you can look at these equations, you have the terms like theta R, which is the residual moisture content, means it's not going to be completely dry. So it's the lowest moisture content you can have. So it's not going to be zero. It's going to be very close to zero. So that's the number is theta R. Theta is the saturated constant, moisture content, which is usually the porosity. So you get that value over here. And then when it comes to hydraulic conductivity, that is also going to be affected by the moisture content, because the lower the moisture content, your hydraulic conductivity will be lower than the saturated conductivity. So there's the term KR, the relative hydraulic conductivity. You multiply with the saturated hydraulic conductivity to get the KUS, the unsaturated hydraulic conductivity. And that comes from this little curve. You can see here the bottom is theta, and you have KR. You see the KR is maximum, which is one at the saturation point. So until you reach the saturation, your hydraulic conductivity is going to be less than the saturated hydraulic conductivity then. So your KR is going to be always equal to or less than one. And to add to that complexity, there's another parameter that you have to deal with at times. It's called hysteresis, because when the soil gets the hysteresis in H versus theta club curve, this is the soil wa water retention curve, we call it. So you have the H versus theta, but you have two different line it follows, right? So theta W is for the wetting front, which means your soil is not fully saturated, but there is a water front coming from the top because of precipitation. So that wetting front comes and it goes down, and that is the path for the wetting front for H versus theta. But when the precipitation is stopped, your wetting front moves down, the backside of the wetting front is going to get dry usually, right? So there's the drying curve. So you have a hysteresis. It doesn't usually follow the same path, but some modelers can just ignore this hysteresis process, because if they're dealing with only the leaching part, not much wetting and drying at the top of the soil surface, then you can actually go with one with that represent the wetting side. So again, to add to the complexity, your H versus theta curve could be depending on how what part of the modeling you are doing, whether it's the wetting part or the drying part. So in summary, this is the Van Gennepen parameters. You have theta R, theta S, the two term residual and saturated moisture content. Alpha and N are actually shaped to keep that S shape kind of H versus theta. You have these parameters which are actually defining the shape of the curve, H versus theta curve. This is the saturated hydraulic conductivity. And he actually tried with five different soil types and kind of tested it out in the lab and calibrated with the model to come up with these numbers. So these are very commonly used based on the type of the soil. But oftentimes people actually start the model with these parameters and then try to calibrate these two parameters to match the H versus theta curve I just showed in the previous slide, and then use the calibrated values for unsaturated zone modeling. All right, so this is the last part where I said I'm going to give a short demonstration of someone who from a journal article that was published a few years back from the guy who was this I met. Harry Simunek, he's a professor from, I'm sorry, he's a professor and he works for USDARS, I think. So they are the publisher. Actually, he is one of the developer of Hydrus model, which is very commonly used for Vedder zone transport modeling. So this is the paper I'm going to refer from now on till the end of our presentation for giving you a demo. So for PFAS transport, you have to look at, again, three phases, right? The air, water, in this figure I had shown, air, water, and the solid phase. So your equation, the advection dispersion equation, will change. So the first part is showing the air, water phase, which is moisture, concentration in the water. This is the moisture content. Second part is the solid phase, where you have partitioning between solid particle. This is the bulk density of the soil. And the third part is added for the air phase, which is showing here. This is the tau is the concentration in the air phase of for PFAS, and this is the area of the air phase in this equation. So and here you see the dispersion term, and this is the advection term. Q is the velocity, groundwater velocity in the unsaturated zone, and finally this is the reaction term. So this is again advection dispersion equation derived from the mass balance, and I have a little a picture of the P4 and PFAS that they have actually used in this demonstration in this paper. All right, so next slide. So what do we do? First, let's look at the partitioning, the sorption that comes with PFAS being involved between solid, air, and water phase, right? So first, the solid water partitioning, which is commonly done through most models, right? So this is the type of equation where you have the solid concentration is a function of the water concentration with the partitioning coefficient KD, that partition between solid and the water phase. There are many different type of model you can use for solid water partitioning. Linear function is good. Frohnlich and Langmuir are also commonly used. Usually, when you're dealing with a low concentration, not to the concentration where your solid phase will be completely occupied by the sorption process, you can actually stick to a linear sorption model. If your concentration in the liquid phase is very high, then you have a chance that the partitioning for the contaminant could maximize to the solid phase. Then you have to deal with Langmuir or Frohnlich type model. That's commonly what we do in modeling. Now, next come the air-water interface. You have the air phase concentration, which is tau here. This is the Langmuir isotherm, where you have a constant KLW, which is the Langmuir constant for air-water interface, and this is the water concentration, and tau is a function of that. And this is the maximum value I was talking about. When you have a very high concentration, this maximum value would be important for picking which type of isotherm you'd go with. The assumption for sorption models are it's an instantaneous process, means that as soon as the water hits the chemical hits the water, it's going to partition into the air or water and the solid, and immediately that reaction will happen immediately. And it's reversible, which means if the water gets cleaned, the back diffusion will start working at the same rate, and it can come back from the solid phase to the liquid phase or from the air phase to the water phase. In this case, it's important because for PFAS, as soon as the water gets saturated, any concentration that was in the air phase will immediately transfer to the water phase. That means it's going to reverse back to the water phase, and from water phase it can partition more into the solid phase. That process is also going to get affected. So to add more complexity to it, you can have this constant as a function of the concentration. Like I was saying, if the concentration is very high, then you have a chance that this constant can be affected by that, which means your differential equation will be getting affected as well when you try to convert these numbers into the equation I just showed earlier. So that would be even more complex. But in general, you have PFAS going to get retained in the air-water interface. It's going to be a function of how much the area that you have. So if your air pocket is big, obviously you have a bigger surface area for partitioning. So there is a chance of more partitioning into the airphase. But as the moisture content increases in the soil media, the area of the air pocket will collapse, will shrink, and then that means your partitioning will be less as well. So the relationship between the area and the moisture content is an inverse relationship. And usually you can derive these from this equation from the soil water retention curve, which is what you have actually begin with from the soil parameters, the hydraulic parameters for the unsaturated soil. There are other complexities also that were discussed in this paper, which is surface tension could be a function of that air pocket air water interface. Viscosity could be affecting also to some extent, especially those are possible when concentration are very high. So when you have higher viscosity, higher concentration like AFFF coming, discharge into the soil surface, a very high concentration, the viscosity of PFAS could affect the unsaturated hydraulic conductivity. So they have done some model calibration from another research work done by Liu et al. In 2018. They did a column test on a one-dimensional column, 15 centimeter long, and with the moisture content, with the constant moisture content in the soil profile. And they set up the model with the boundary condition. Like any modeling you do, numerical modeling, you have to have boundary condition defined at the top and bottom for the flow and the transport model for you to solve that model, right? So the boundary condition used in this calibration process for the column study was constant moisture content at the top and bottom for the flow model, and for the transport model, concentration flux at the top, which means you have a concentration coming as a mass flux coming from the top, and zero concentration gradient at the bottom. That means when at the bottom you have water tables, at the water table the concentration in the water table and above the water table are same, which means zero concentration gradient at the bottom.
And Noman, I just want to give you a quick time check. It is 2:12.
So 5 more minutes?
About 5 minutes, yeah.
Okay. So I'm going slower than I thought. All right, so when the model was calibrated, the first thing is to calibrate the air-water interface, and the hydraulic parameters calibration was done, alpha, N, and K, like I was saying, and you try to match this black dotted line with the red dotted line, and these three are for the different soil types, the Van Gennepen soil types that you have. So they used a linear relation for a air water the area of the air water interface with the SW, which is the ratio of the soil moisture content as a function over the saturated moisture content. So it's basically the a factor for moisture content. So if you look at area versus moisture content at maximum, your air pocket area goes down to zero, almost close to zero, which means no saturated soil. You come down at a very low moisture content, you have the maximum air the area available for partitioning in the air water interface. And the next thing they match is that with the breakthrough curve, the C by C naught versus time, the breakthrough curve I was showing earlier, how it shows like a bell shape type, the more high retardation factor you have, the more spreading you get at the bottom. So as you can see, as area approaches to zero, this is one in here and so on and so forth. I just trying to go a little faster now. So when they after the calibration, they went on to do another run for model simulation for a different set, for a hypothetical set with two different soil types, with two different parameter set, one for PFOA and one for PFOS. And as you can see, this is the dispersion parameter. This is sorry, diffusion parameter. This is the partitioning coefficient with the soil. This is the partitioning coefficient for the air-water interface, and you can see very high value for PFOS versus P4. So PFOS is partitioning a lot more than P4 in here. That means PFOS has a long carbon fluoride chain versus P4 in here. This is the significant difference between the two chemicals in here and the two different type of soil that I was showing you earlier was set up this way. So they were set up with a 500 centimeter column and set up the boundary condition like the one I was saying earlier, and put a concentration of 1 milligram per liter at the top, and it stays that way for about 15 years and goes down to 0.5 after 15 years, and it's all in milligram per liter. And the same boundary condition for the transport model like the one for the column test. So as you can see over here, this is 0 days is the initial condition before the model start to kick in. So as you can see, this is 10 days, 15 days, 50 days, and then 100 days and 1 year. As you can see, this is the waiting front that is moving down to the water table down in the bottom at 500 centimeter. Okay, so it's moving down. For loam sand, it's this one way. For loam is this way. For loamy sand, it's still different. It's the two different hydraulic properties are for the reason for this difference in here. You can see the same. This is the same curve in terms of the area. This is in terms of surf, the saturation percentage, and this is in terms of the area of the air pocket, right? So these two are related, as we were saying, through the linear relationship I was showing in the earlier slide. So you can see that these figures are entirely depending on hydraulic properties, nothing to do with the properties of the P4 PFAS in here, just for demonstration. So this is the slide where you can see the comparison between the soil with no air water interface adsorption versus with air water first adsorption. This is just for demonstration from that journal article. One thing I just note over here that the solid phase option is dominant for both P4 and PFAS than the air water interface. I think it's because the mass transfer to from the air pocket to the water pocket ha water phase happen as soon as the soil gets saturated. So that's probably why you have this kind of relationship. This is an interesting slide. I just wanted to spend a little more time on this one. You can see the sensitivity of KD and the air water partitioning because of the air water interface. Usually, we define the retardation factor up to this point. KD is the soil water partitioning, and this is the part added for the air water interface, the partitioning between the air water interface. So if you look at these figures, when the moisture content is low, your retardation factor is very high. And as it goes down in the direction to the saturation, the retardation factor starts to kind of flatten out, which means when your soil is unsaturated, this part is going to have a significant contribution for retardation of the plume to, for PFAS to move down, right? Now this figure down here kind of goes a little bit further with showing that the KD values has different KD values with this gray line, and the red line are the KD values that are almost to the point to the zeros, close to the zero for PFAS, and then higher KD values are these. So you can see with for the low KD values, which means the soil, the P4 or PFAS that has very little partitioning between the solid phase, which is the case for shorter chain PFAS products, right? You'll see a low KD value, right? So for low KD values, this retardation factor could be a significant part when it when you count the air water partition. But when you have a very high KD value for longer chain PFAS particles or PFOS, you will see that this part is not as significant because even at saturated condition, you have a very high KD value over here for the for this. So given your type of PFAS compound, this air-water interface could be a significant contributor for retardation. And when we deal with, we talk about PFAS migration, the shorter chain one is the one we talk about moving into groundwater and moving further down in, into the plume. And that's the one is not going to be affected as much in the, you know, sorry, I would say that's the shorter chain one are the one is going to be significantly retarded by the air-water interface because of that. If you look at this curve here, the proportion is very, the slope is very sharp in these figures where the KD values are low. This slide is again for a demonstration of how when it reaches the 70 nanogram per liter, when you compare the two, you know, soil that one has sorption and one without air-water interface. This one is, the last column is without the air-water interface, and this one is with the air-water interface. And if you can see here, the only soil that has a significant difference in here is the models and the one, the Liu et al. I was talking about the journal article that they used for the column study. That sand was the one was showing significant difference in the time of arrival for the leading front to reach 70 nanogram. Okay, but rest of it was pretty good. So I think it's probably because the KD values are low. So you know, these are the shorter chains, and that's why it's probably showing that relationship. All right, so this is my last slide. So things to note again, as you can see, the modeling solid transport for Verdozone is complex. When it comes to the PFAS migration, it's even more complex because you have this little part where you have to establish an equation for air, you know, the area of the air pockets in unsaturated zone for as a function of theta, and that's not going to be an easy thing to do. There are some research publication where you can pick those up. You can design your own work to get a relationship established for this curve. The standards unsaturated zone models will require you to have an H versus theta, which is also not an easy thing to collect in the field. You have to set up the equipment. You have to put those pressure transducers at the point where you can measure the suction potentials at different depth of your column, at different moisture content, and establish this relationship. Oftentimes, you get this data, and then you calibrate the, you know, model parameters to come, you know, complete your model calibration for hydraulic properties, which involves not just H versus theta, the, you know, in this case, area of the air pocket. And then also the hydraulic conductivity as a function of theta is also important for Verdozone modeling. So it requires a lot of effort. You can start with the Van Gennepen model, which I just showed. It's pretty commonly used. For PFAS, of course, the air water interface sorption is an important part. And it's going to be significant depending on, you know, what type of PFAS you are trying to model here. If the PFAS has low KD, your air-water interface will be a significant part for retardation of that of those type of PFAS compounds. And also the thing you have to remember that as soon as the soil becomes saturated, all those concentration in the air pocket will come back to the water phase and give you a spike in concentration. And finally, it requires a lot of effort for the data collection. As you can see, I've been pointing out throughout the presentation that these are the data that you need, which is a lot more than a saturated zone modeling. Or and then you add the complexity of PFAS partitioning in the air-water interfaces is another process that you have to collect the data from. So just to give you an idea of how complex it can become when you deal with PFAS, which behaves like a surfactant, as you know, but people are doing this kind of modeling and data collection. I've been to a Battelle conference last year. There are a number of papers that were actually poster presentation mostly that were they were trying to do modeling for PFAS migration in unsaturated zone. With that, I would say time for question. I
All
think
right. We do have some
I was
questions.
right on the limit, I guess.
No, you're good. You're good. I'll just remind the audience that if they have questions for you, they can continue to submit them through the Q&A window. I'm going to start reading through questions. We'll try to get through as many as we can in the time that we have allotted. Our very first question is asking, how are those values for AAW obtained? Is it a calibration parameter?
Well, can I see my screen or?
You should be able to see. I can still see your slides right now.
Okay, you can, right?
Yep, we can.
So, in this paper, they use a linear relationship like this one for air-water interface as a linear function of the moisture content. So, which is a very simplistic model. And there was discussion about nonlinear relationship also, and people are debating which one is better. So there are a number of publications referred in this journal article that was published a couple of years back, and there, I think there are more. So this is something that you have to again calibrate for your model. For say, for example, you have the model that you have the data for your breakthrough. You have the breakthrough curve that you collected from your laboratory experiment or from your field experiment. You start with this relationship and see if you can match your breakthrough curve like they did in here. And if it doesn't work, you feel like this is where you have to make some changes, maybe you can go with. So I would say, look at the literature and see if there are any other model that or relationship between air water interface versus the moisture content is available. But in this is the one they used in, that I highlighted in here.
Okay. Does hysteresis affect the retardation?
It should because you have. Your retardation, this is the hysteresis plot over here, right? So, your retardation factor equation that I was showing you is it has the air water, the moisture content versus the area. So, if your area of the air pocket is a function of moisture content, it can actually affect. But what people usually do in unsaturated zone modeling, they try to assume there's no hysteresis given that you are only dealing with the wetting front, so you're not constantly drying and put your top of your model where the water is coming from is not is a continuous source, then you don't have to deal with hysteresis. If the precipitation is kind of on and off, then you have to deal with that. So if you are only looking at the wetting front, you don't need to look at the drying curve. You just stick with the wetting curve.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about what site data is important to collect so that you can adequately constrain parameters involved in your PFAS, fate, and transport modeling?
That's a very good question. This is the most difficult part. What data you have to collect, right? So first of all, you need to sorry, I just So if you look at the very first thing, you need to have the H versus theta curve, right? So you have to have theta for measuring the suction potential at different depth and at different moisture content, right? So you have in this column study that they did, the one I was showing the calibration, what they have done, they took a model sand, which is basically quartz type sand, very simplistic type of media, and then they put different at different depth, they put the pressure measurement equipments, and then ran the moisture and measured the moisture content and the suction potential at different depths. So, and that's when you can actually come to something like these and calibrate your model to, let me see. So to establish this H versus theta curve is the first thing you need to collect, right? And then you need to look at if you can have some hydraulic conductivity data that you can collect in the same routine. And a lot of those parameters you have to then again calibrate, like the Van Gennepen parameters I was talking about, alpha and n. When you have the breakthrough curve, at whether you are collecting the concentration versus time curve, which is the breakthrough curve, you need to match these parameters and see if you can get to the breakthrough curve, shape of the breakthrough curve that you are getting. So, again, the list of parameters is going to be a lot more effort involved than a saturated zone model. So I would say, actually, I should have make a list of parameters like this. This is a good question. I think I need to add that in a slide in future.
Sure. We did have a question that came in on short chain PFAS. They're wondering what are the fate and transport processes for the short chains. They're just wondering how much they might differ from the long chain PFAS, like the PFAS PFOA that you talked about today.
On this one, I was gonna say one of the slides, I think I have the little. Okay, so when you have long chain, the difference between long chain and short chain, the long chain would try to partition into the airspace more than the short chain, right? So when you deal with the longer chain, you would expect the partitioning to the airspace would be critical, and also the longer chain would be partitioning with the solid particle also. So your chances of getting into the water particle is less compared to the shorter chain. So in this demonstration that was presented in here, you can see this PFOS. So I have a table for, you can see PFOS has a very high air water interface in here. So my pointer kind of went away. Let me see. Yeah, this is, you see the how big, how large this is now. It's two orders of magnitude higher than the PFOS. So this is the longer chain component that they try to model in here. You can look at the KD value for PFAS is also higher compared to PFOA in here. So again, for longer chain, you'd expect it to be partitioning more with the solid and the air pocket. Airspace versus the shortest.
Okay, we do have a clarification getting back to the data that needs to be collected question. They're wondering if you can explain in terms of field data that's collected. For example, if they're collecting soil and groundwater samples, what are the key constituents to measure in addition to PFAS? If they collect soil cores and then take samples for PFAS, should they also be collecting their TOCs, their pH, their grain size, anything else that they would need?
Well, I think the question is possibly related to saturated zone. When it comes to saturated zone, your partitioning between the solid and the water particle is the most important. So basically, KD is what you need to do, right? So you cannot collect KD information from field data. You have to go to the laboratory, whether you to a batch test or a column test to get your KD value. So your data collection for field in this in this in you know in a groundwater investigation would be same as this. So now when you get a soil core and you want to do a column test with that core, that's what is important. If you bring that to the lab, you want to do the soil organic content to a batch test for finding the KD or PFAS partitioning into the solid particle. So those are the things that are routine like any other contaminants for modeling purpose when it comes to the saturated zone. The only difference it makes is when you are dealing with an unsaturated zone model, your data collection effort would be lot more intensive and diverse also.
All right, we have a series of additional questions that are still in the queue, but I do realize we're a little bit past our scheduled end time. And I've got a couple of people noted that they're going to have to hop off. So I want to close with one last question for you, because we did have a number of individuals who indicated at the start of today's session that they're new to modeling. And they're wondering if you could provide references or sources to learn more about groundwater modeling tools. So if there's a USGS publication, is there an EPA center that has training videos, or if there's an EPA modeling software that has some good user guides that they could start with?
I would say for those who are new to modeling, you start with analytical models, and there are free downloadable versions like BioChlor and RemChlor. Those are very good modeling software packages that EPA has developed, and those are free level. You can Google and download those. And I think we have actually put some demos in there to learn some modeling. If you can get used to with the analytical model, the next step would be a transport, numerical model. And usually when you buy those packages, like if you buy Visual Modflow, or I'm a heavy user of Visual Modflow, and they give you the demo modeling files that you can go with and practice with. There are no, actually, that I know, training or something that I can recall where you learn. Personally, I learned from my academic, from my graduate class, and then I did PhD on modeling. So that's how I learned. I think for those who are wants to learn from work, I think the best place to go is to start with the analytical model. And there are many books that discusses with numerical model, and I think I can give you a list, maybe some in future. I need to post it, but and you can Google as well.
All right, excellent. Well, I know we're a bit over on time, so I think I'm going to close out the Q&A period. But Norman, if there are EPA or other regulators on the line and they have additional questions, could they reach out to you to follow up with some of the topics you talked about today?
Absolutely, yeah. That's the whole purpose to, to spread the message, get more people, engaged in the process. Yes.
All right,
Feel free to
wonderful.
reach out to me, and whether you're EPA or outside EPA, we're always open to help.
Wonderful. Well, with that, I want to thank you so much for your time and sharing your expertise with the audience. I want to thank the over 400 people who joined us from all over the world for today's session. I'm going to walk through just a few quick final reminders before we close things out today. First and foremost, I hope that you all are regular visitors at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org and are subscribed to the free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that I send out on the first of each month. In that newsletter, you'll find out about technical training like today's session. So if you aren't a subscriber, I encourage you to visit us and sign up. If you missed it at the beginning, remember there is a unique seminar homepage for today's session. The URL is shown in red at the top of the slide. You can access it with the QR code as well. That website will remain active from today forward. You can access copies of the presentation materials on that site. And if you scroll further down, you'll see a section for the online feedback form. If you would like a certificate of participation, please fill out that online feedback form, making sure to fill out the complete form and then check the box at the bottom that says you were here for the entire session. And then as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll immediately have access to download or print out a certificate of participation. If you hosted a viewing party and had others join you at your location, please simply send people to that seminar homepage and they can each fill out the feedback form and get their own certificate of participation, even if they didn't register individually. Now, sometimes people will wait for the emailed version of the certificate, but occasionally those do get caught up in junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download the certificate immediately once you fill out that form. If you are one of the lucky ones who are watching the recorded version of today's session, right about now in the online archive, you'll see buttons in the upper right in the recorded version, which will allow you to go over to the seminar homepage as well as access that feedback form. You can still share your feedback based on the replay of today's session and get a certificate of participation as long as you check the box noting you watched the entire archive. For those of you who are here with me live, I'll automatically send you each an email as soon as the archive is available with instructions on how to access it. Look for that in about 1 week. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. Again, I want to thank Noman for joining us and sharing his expertise today. And I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.